Some of my fellow Canadians have really been like talking shit about Tim Hortons to me lately, and I don't stand for it.
Don't say that in front of Hannah. It's very sensitive for her.
I think that Tim Hortons is a wonderful thing that we have. And no, they don't pay their employees
Yeah,
properly.
they're definitely a
They're not a good
horrible company.
company.
They definitely sold themselves to Americans.
But as a culinary institution, guys, Tim Hortons coffee, don't act like you're above it. Have you ever been on a road trip? Don't tell me you're above Tim Hortons coffee. Have you ever worked something so early that nothing is open but Tim Hortons? Then don't tell me you're above Tim Hortons coffee. It's there for us when we need it.
I know I'm going on a road trip. I look forward to it days in advance. I also order it for Hannah and our camera guy, Aiden, when we film my videos. And I'm sure Aiden's probably like, this shit is disgusting, but I don't know. It just does the job. It's
No.
also one of the only affordable places to get food anymore.
Yeah, also, shout out Aiden. He drinks Tim Hortons coffee black, which means he's a real one. He's
Yeah.
taking it raw.
He raw dogs that
Tim Hortons
coffee.
coffee.
Yeah, you were saying that you were talking to people who were saying that the bagels were bad.
Yeah, the bagels are incredible. Just gonna put that out there. I love a Tim Hortons bagel, not because it's cheap, but because I think it's a superior bagel.
Here's the thing. Okay. I've been complaining about this a lot recently, as I do, and it's that a lot of restaurants pop up that try to gourmetify low culture food. Like you see a lot of whatever these like street food places where they'll sell street food from other countries, but then they'll like jack up the prices and be like, look, guys. And I think the same with bagels, even.
Well, a lot of like kind of diner staples and fast food
Like gourmet
items.
grilled cheese store. It's like, what the fuck is
Yeah.
that?
It's like, how can we just make this taste less like it originally tasted, which was the thing that made it taste so awesome, and then like charge more money for it so people can be like, look, I'm at a quote unquote diner. But it's like, that's not a diner. If you want to go to a diner, go to Aerie's Place on Rawson's Fells for my Toronto folks.
Yeah, the entire enjoyment out of these types of foods is that they're cheap. I know that Tim Hortons isn't the creme de la creme of cuisine, but I do think that it tastes good because I know I just spent 99 cents on an item there.
Yeah, I love being like, ha 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 ha, look at my $4 lunch of a coffee and a bagel.
Yeah, I think we've just forgotten how to enjoy cheap things and like we refuse to do it, and I think that's really sad.
Not me.
Honestly, should we bring back fast food? Like,
Should
what's the
we?
thing? Well, even fast food places are also
Too
jacking up their prices.
expensive.
McDonald's isn't a cheap place you can just go get a bite anymore. It's so overpriced.
The days of the $5 footlong are way in our past, my friends. It is like $11 for a 6-inch sub.
Subway also has a tipping option now, which is actually insane. I'm like, pay your workers.
Pay your workers. But also, Subway is the only kind of fast food place that's open by us late at night. So, shout out to Subway.
Did you hear that recently Wendy's said that they wanted to surge price? So
Wait.
at peak times, their prices go up.
That is whoever
Evil.
the people behind Uber are going to burn in hell.
I hope they do. I hope
But
they
also,
do.
I'm sorry, you say Wendy's Wendy's.
I know it's been a thing. Kids made fun of me growing up for it.
Really? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to drudge up old trauma.
Yeah, I don't know. It's really actually sensitive for me in the way that talking about Tim Hortons is sensitive for you.
Okay, well, at least we have that that we can agree on.
I'm Aya.
And I'm Hannah.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is a loose, no pun intended, history of sex on the internet, the symbiosis of humanity's two most basic instincts, innovation and getting off. If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts because that helps us out a lot. Get us up to a 4.9.
Yeah, I'm sick of this 4.7 shit. We're not 4.7.
We're not 4.7. We got review bombed, and that's not fair to us.
Thank you.
In 1996, the student at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania named Jennifer Ringley turned on a camera in her dorm room and essentially changed the digital world as we know it. Basically, Jennifer wanted to experiment with what it would be like to live under 24-hour self-imposed surveillance and broadcast that to other people. So she did this on a website called the Jenny Cam, and she broadcasted this 24-hour camera to a dozen or so of her friends.
Yeah, I've heard of this.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay, well, perfect. You're in for not that thrilling of a ride.
No, it's been a while. I can't wait to hear more.
So Jennifer cleaned in front of the cam. She studied. She slept. Sometimes she even masturbated and accumulated viewers as she went. And even when she wasn't home, you could still kind of like peruse the site. You could read her diary. You could engage in this chat forum with each other. And you could also look at photos in her archive from like past days.
Mm-hmm.
5 years before that, in 1991, a computer scientist at Cambridge named Quentin Stafford Fraser placed a camera on a Trojan coffee pot in the staff lounge and uploaded the live footage to the university's computer network. So basically, the issue had been that the coffee pot would be brewing and people from further floors, by the time they got to the coffee pot, either all the coffee was gone or it was kind of stale. So this would alert everyone in the building as to when the pot was ready.
Whoa, that's... But then you'd have to be on the live stream to check.
I know. I think maybe people would have it maybe in a window.
In like 90s computer tech, I feel like that would ruin your like...
I know. People were just addicted to coffee back then, I guess.
Damn, friends, the impact it had on our culture is unmeasurable.
Don't talk to me till I have my morning coffee. So bizarrely, the Trojan Room coffee pot cam took off with the public and accumulated about 2 million hits to the site while it was up between 1991 and 2001.
So we've always been like this.
Yeah, we've always been addicted.
Okay.
This was pre-alternative milk too, so.
This is comforting, kind of, to
oh, yeah.
know.
Oh yeah. Hannah currently has a cup of coffee that she made at home sitting next to her.
Yes.
She does a thing where she puts an ice cube in it, which I find fascinating.
Because I don't like to have my tongue burnt, and so when I have a boiling beverage, I like it to not be boiling so I can drink it faster.
Well, my dad taught me this thing where you and Hannah, it's just terrible for everyone around you, but you basically slurp the hot liquid basically so that it gets air into the liquid as it's coming into your mouth, and it actually doesn't burn your tongue.
Oh, okay. I might stick to the ice cubes.
Maybe don't do it on the pod.
Less messy.
So the coffee pot was a thing, and also in the 90s, there were other people at this time playing around with this thing called Life Cams, which was a webcam that would basically take photos every few minutes and upload them to a given website. So people would, like, essentially film themselves with it, just going about their everyday life, and they'd put it up for, like, their tens of friends, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer was using this technology. So she was by no means the first to do this, but in a bid to commit herself to the completely unmediated real, an act that people would later describe as performance art, her life cam audience skyrocketed to unprecedented heights when she displayed unadulterated sex with her then boyfriend for everyone to see.
Right.
The Jenny Cam was so unfathomably popular that at its peak in 1998, it was generating 100 million hits a week.
That is crazy.
people want to see what
back
they want to see.
On the 90s, like a fraction of people had the internet.
This was monoculture. Like,
wow.
People, they were tuning in for OJ, and they were tuning in to see Jenny and her boyfriend have unprotected sex.
And so where's the, like, Ryan Murphy miniseries about this then?
Oh, I'm sure it's coming.
Okay.
And it will only last one season. Despite the sexual content that happened to be on the site, Jennifer was adamant that the Jenny Cam was not made for the purposes of pornography. She said it was simply like an experiment in the voyeurism of daily life. And some people agreed with this. Like, feminist scholars wrote that the Jenny Cam was a complex dialectic between woman as subject and woman as object, woman as both consumer and consumed, which, you know, is fascinating. CNN called it a voluntarily Orwellian existence. But if the Jenny Cam revealed how much people are interested in, like, peering into the monotony of a regular person's life, they were doubly interested in watching a regular person have sex.
Right.
So what we had with the Pam and Tommy episode where people want to peep into celebrity lives, this actually proved that people also want to peep into randos lives.
I think there's something even more fascinating about someone could be your neighbor. Well, obviously Pam and Tommy have like an exceptional life, and I'm sure that that extends beyond what we see and into their private lives. But you know, you don't know what the regular old people on the street are like, and I think we do want to look into their lives. I feel like almost even for comparison.
Yeah.
Just to be like, what are other normal people like?
When you're walking on the street, if there's like a window where someone's light is on, do you ever kind of like just stand back and kind of see what's going to happen?
Oh, yeah, definitely. But then I'm like, oh, but you could see me. Yeah, yeah. You.
Unfortunately, they could see you.
I am someone who accidentally stares at people and will kind of forget that I'm also in the space. But if someone's like caught my attention for whatever reason, I will realize that I'm just staring at this person, like perceiving them, forgetting that I'm could also be perceived. So yes.
And it makes for a really awesome interchange.
It's great.
I feel like you're never staring at me.
Well, I see you all the time.
I used to actually have these old neighbors who were, there are these houses in Toronto, and I'm sure they're in other major cities as well, where we have a lot of Victorian or Edwardian style houses that have smaller windows, but then they'll kind of like tear one down randomly in the middle of a street and put up this hideous monstrosity that's like all windows. It's like gray. And usually people just have their blinds closed because obviously the windows are too big and they're too on the street so everyone can see inside.
Yeah.
But this one couple that was across from me, like their windows faced my bedroom window, were just exhibitionists. Like the woman would work out in lingerie. Very confusing. And they'd like make out and stuff and you could just see it all. And I kind of had no problem watching because I was like, well, your blinds are open.
Yeah, why not?
And I wanted to see what was up. I felt like I knew them, you know? So as much as she resisted this moniker, Jennifer is largely considered the first cam girl. The term Jenny Cam was actually used to lure people to hardcore porn sites at the time.
Whoa.
And even to this day, it's used as a meta tag in porn, which this blogger, Stephen Baldwin, he had this blog post about Jenny that I thought was really great. But he said back in 2004 that this was an odd but not unique case of meta information outliving the information to which it originally and erroneously referred. So, you know, Jenny Cam just being decontextualized.
Yeah, like it grew beyond its like immediate meaning.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Also, kind of like our season 2 episodes.
Yes. Well, this is kind of the demonic turn, like just thinking about her as a normal person.
Yeah, totally.
Transcending that. It all makes sense given the time period that this is happening. It's like the time of the real world. We're only a few years away from like Big Brother and from like these very observationally based reality shows.
No, that totally makes sense. I think technology and the internet definitely played a huge role in the demonic turn. It's like how people on MySpace would get famous a bit later than this, but you know. Yeah. Most interestingly, though, was that many men that had been watching Jenny kind of every day started to regard her as their virtual girlfriend. And a lot of them talked about that publicly, like when they were interviewed.
Parasocial relationship.
Parasocial. And when Jenny Cam finally shut down in 2003, her major reason for doing so, other than just like, you know, fatigue with filming yourself every day, was that PayPal had recently introduced an anti-nudity policy, which made it impossible to sustain the site. And I think it's just safe to say that the life cycle of the Jenny Cam is an early warning for what was to come.
Well, yes. Curse you, Elon Musk. Well, he...
Question mark. Yeah, he make PayPal. Yeah.
Unless this is a post-Musk PayPal.
Others pretty quickly caught on to how lucrative sexiness on camera could be. And so other life casting sites like the Amanda Cam, for example, started popping up like in the 90s that featured more explicit sexual content as well as just daily life stuff. Less DIY sites like Justin.tv, which was a creation of these early tech entrepreneurs. It actually blew up by teasing viewers with the prospect of their subject, Justin, having sex on camera. And fun fact, Justin.tv actually later evolved into what is now known as Twitch.
What?
Yeah.
Okay, also Justin.tv is giving the Truman Show.
Yeah, it's just the Truman Show.
Justin.tv. I love it.
Except I think Justin knew that he was being filmed.
It's just the name of it. That's so funny.
Justin.tv. Yeah, this really is the Truman Show. And I'm sure the Truman Show was inspired by these types of technologies, you know?
Yeah, the Truman Show kind of like came out at an interesting period where it feels like it both predicted what's to come but also commented on what was already happening.
Well, it's always amazing when we think things are phenomena that are happening right now, but actually they've been happening for quite a long time. Like, and I think this is an interesting example of that. Like, the panopticon has almost always been there since the beginning of the internet and cameras.
Also, like, the influence, I'm sure, of 1984 on something.
So after this, actual dedicated websites like the Amateur Cam Network and Live Jasmine then sprung up that were dedicated solely to sex camming. And what made these sites different from the Jenny Cam was that the models were aware of the camera and like performing for it rather than just going about their everyday life and kind of like ignoring the camera.
Mm-hmm.
In her book, How Sex Changed the Internet and the Internet Changed Sex, which has been extremely important for the research of this season, Samantha Cole describes the women on these sites as performing something close to immersive theater and says that their work involves a similar emotional labor to other forms of sex work like stripping and street sex work and escorting. Camgirling essentially transformed the sex work industry in a few major ways. So thinking back to the Fosta Sesta episode where we talked about how street work was so differentiated, how do you think camgirling is different from that and like other forms of traditional sex work?
Well, something I kind of found very interesting when researching the Pam and Tommy episode was how camgirling kind of felt like the internet's way of developing what was already existent with like phone sex technology, just in the kind of back and forth between like the consumer and the performer. But then camgirling, because it's on video, you kind of have to prove that you're doing the things that you're saying you're doing. So it requires more involvement. It's, I assume, much more intimate than doing phone sex. And I think it's interesting because of the lack of touch and the distance, I would assume that it would have more of an emphasis on like female pleasure because...
Ooh, interesting.
Ultimately,
yeah.
That's what they're watching, right? They're watching a woman react.
Like, and she's getting off for them. It's almost exclusively masturbation.
Yeah.
I mean, they do other stuff as well, but...
I think that there is something really interesting about that, about people preferring to see a woman pleasure herself alone versus being with a man, because I guess it's a more intimate act if you are watching the camming or whatever, but I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah. It is interesting because it is equally almost performative as stripping, like just that it's a performance of sexuality, but then also at the same time, yeah, there is this element of gratification on the part of the performer. And like we had been talking about before this, there are cam sites like Chatterbait or like Live Jasmine where they'll be hooked up to this Love Sense technology, which is those like remote vibrators. So I'm pretty sure what happens is that the client can like pay to press a button that essentially triggers the vibrator, which I think is so fascinating.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and I get that it's more interactive. Yeah, it's a kind of its own thing for sure. Mm-hmm. Like, it feels more intimate maybe than like stripping because of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like its own thing.
That makes a lot of sense. I like what you said about female pleasure. I didn't even think about that. Yeah, so there is like, you know, as you're saying, since these girls are filming in their own rooms, like it does give this appearance of authenticity and intimacy, and also this appearance of amateurism that you wouldn't necessarily find with, let's say, like professionally made porn, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Also, as opposed to street sex work, like we talked about in the Fosta Sesta episode, online sex work is much safer.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you said, there's like a huge distance between the workers and their clients.
Yeah.
And it's interesting you're bringing up phone sex too, because it's also been placed in this category that's called technological mediated indirect services.
Whoa.
So that includes camgirling, phone sex, and chat sex, because basically these services get rid of the middleman. So like porn producers are pimps essentially, and it puts the production into the hands of the workers themselves.
Yeah.
So like going back to the Sasha Gray episode, the camgirls basically become sexual entrepreneurs. Similar to what feminists said about like the Jenny Cam, Fiona Atwood, this scholar says that since camgirls control their own businesses, quote, they take on the power relations of looking, defying objectification, and experimenting with ways of refusing, commanding, and controlling the spectator's gaze, which I think really ties in well with what you're saying about this added element of female pleasure or like emphasis on it.
Yeah.
And because they're sexual entrepreneurs, camgirling also took on kind of like a more neoliberal model than other forms of sex work, because they essentially kind of have to like strategize their brands to maintain a competitive edge because they're on this site filled with other girls.
Well, I was going to say it kind of sounds like they're the original content creators. If you look at the Jenny Cam, like two things it's predicting is going to be our fascination with just like the mundanity of people's lives, like watching vlogs, following influencers, like following a person, and then the future of what like sex online is going to be. So it's really interesting. I think in a way, camgirlers, especially when they're doing it themselves, they... Did I say camgirlers?
You did, and I thought it was funny.
He made a face, and I was like, wait.
Camgirlers.
But in a way, camgirls truly are original or, like, early models of content creators.
Yeah, totally. Sorry, this just reminded me of when I referred to Jacob Elordi as a heartthrobber in my last video, and no one has commented on it, which is so funny.
And now you're bringing attention to it?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think this idea of, like, self-promotion is a big thing. It's kind of in the way that, like, a lot of strip clubs will have, like, the strippers come out and do their performance and then work the floor afterwards. Mm-hmm. So you kind of get to see who you like out of them. It's almost similar to that, but then, yeah, even more heightened, more similar to the influencer that we know now.
Yeah, it sounds competitive because it's like if you're all providing like what are fairly identical services, how do you stand out? How do you make yourself special?
Exactly. So in my research, I also got the idea that a cam girl's success is really dependent on how many hours she invests into it. Like, it takes on this very motivational culture.
Sounds like Twitch, too.
Yes, and I was going to ask, do you think this kind of reminds you of MLM philosophy almost?
Well, I think MLMs are kind of seizing on this mindset of you can take things into your own hands and, like, be your own boss, which there are avenues where you can be your own boss, especially now there's, like, more and more options for that, but it doesn't always work out. Like, an MLM is sort of, like, a weird way of making you work for somebody under the guise of being your own boss.
Yeah, totally.
But I can see, like, the mindset of our current economy where it's like you could be using all of these hours to profit off of something if you just invest the time and you just, like, build yourself and network. And I think that's something that the internet has really intensified.
Yeah, it's early hustle culture almost.
Yes.
Yeah, I've watched these videos critiquing MLMs, basically. And there's this one video I watched where they have, like, a Zoom call that they kind of infiltrated with, I don't know what they're called, like, cohorts? I don't know what they're called. They have weird jargon names, but it's, like, yeah, these cohorts, and basically this woman is talking to, I'm just going to call them her underlings. I know that they have...
her minions.
Her little minions. Like, I know that they have actual terms for it, but I just can't remember. And she's basically, like, okay, Tina, well, maybe you did a bad job and maybe you feel like this company isn't working for you because you are lazy. And, like, you're lazy. You're not putting enough hours. I know that you're feeding your baby half the day, but, like, maybe you should spend less time feeding your baby and more time on your computer and more time getting out there and hustling. And I think, I'm not saying camgirling sites are the same, but, like you're saying, working for someone, these girls are kind of, in a way, working for the platform.
Well, that is the internet economy, right? It's the Rachel Hollis of it all, which we talked about in our Girl Boss episode, where in her book for advice, she's like, I don't care if you've been working all day and you're, like, a single mom or whatever, wake up at 5 a.m. and, like, start working on your passion. Don't watch TV at night. Work on your passion. Sleep 2 hours a day. Work on your passion, you know?
And honestly, how many hours a day can you be self-gratifying? Like, that must be exhausting.
And, like, a very miserable existence. But I think that if you listen to influencers talk similarly to people in MLMs, they are like, I'm up early and I'm hustling all day because you kind of have to if you want success.
It's those TikTokers being like, have you seen the ones in public where they'll put their phone and they record like 17 different videos in one go?
Yeah.
And they're like, guys, influencing is actually harder than you'd think. But like camgirling, yes, it is hard to survive and actually make a full-time income on here. Like, you do have to be working hard.
Yeah, I imagine it's incredibly competitive.
Yeah. Ultimately, though, camgirling was seen as a net positive because sex workers could operate from the safety of their own homes and you'd have full creative control and you'd make your own hours. Mm-hmm. But while these cracks that we're talking about in these innovations were starting to form already during the camgirl era, they would be blown wide open with the rise of OnlyFans.
Ah, that guy.
That freaking guy. So, OnlyFans was founded in 2016 by Timothy Stokely, a British entrepreneur known as the King of Homemade Porn, because before OnlyFans, he also owned the cam sites Glam Girls and Customs For You, which I think is really
that
funny.
That sounds like an offshoot of Pimp My Ride. Customs For You.
OnlyFans follows a subscription model of revenue. Fans pay a monthly fee between $5 and $50 to unlock exclusive content made by the worker, mm-hmm. which includes phone calls, direct messaging, group chats, photos, and videos. And OnlyFans takes 20% of those earnings.
20%?
Yeah, I mean, that's a normal commission for like an agent, for example, right? Like camming sites, fans can also tip creators if something they post really speaks to them. As of 2021, the platform was averaging around 174 million monthly visits.
Wow.
150 million registered users and 1.5 million content creators, which when you think about it is like an entire city made up of adult performers.
Wow, that is so true.
A 2022 study also found that the major user base of OnlyFans was white, married males who identify as hetero, bi, or pansexual. Married was the most interesting part to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think it makes sense.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
You gotta get your nut sometimes.
Yeah. Your wife sucks.
Your wife is frigid.
Yeah, she's a bitch and you shouldn't have married her. Sorry.
Yeah. Hannah, what was your first exposure to OnlyFans? And like, have you ever even just in a throwaway sense been like, oh, I should make an OnlyFans?
I haven't because I think that I don't have the entrepreneurial spirit, frankly. But I can't remember when I first heard of it. I think it must have been before the pandemic, right? I was just knew that it was like a place where you could see nudes or like content, but it was like paywalled, was just my understanding of it. Yeah, I can't remember when I first would have heard of it.
Yeah, I also can't remember a distinct time I heard of it, but yeah, I understood it the same way as the nudes site. I actually had these two friends back in like, I think it was 2019. We were all so broke, and we were all like, okay, the three of us are gonna make an OnlyFans together. And then they got really serious about it, and immediately I was like, no, I don't want to do this anymore. But they came to my house to like take photos and stuff, and I was like, oh, I don't know if I want to do this. And then they left it up to me to create the OnlyFans, and it was really hard to figure out. The interface was hard, and I was like, I don't think I want to do this, and I gave up. Also, I think it's funny to have an OnlyFans with three girls.
Yeah,
I guess you could like charge more because it's like three in one.
I feel like you're kind of actually minimizing your profit potential because you are really getting,
yeah, totally.
Yeah,
you're splitting the revenue with
I think it's
girls.
A bad business.
Yeah, it was a bad business model. Yeah. Glad it didn't happen. I think what's kind of special about OnlyFans is that it functions very similarly to like a social media site. It's very similar to Patreon. The stuff on OnlyFans operates like content. So like there are various posts that users can engage with by like liking or commenting on it. So in the way like the Jenny Cam had a message board available when she was out of her dorm, OnlyFans has like the social aspect and operates kind of like a digital community in the way that a social media platform would.
It sounds like Patreon.
It's like the social media-ification of sex work. I'm gonna get womaned so hard if I keep saying ification all the time.
Ification? No, we're in the ification culture.
Yes. Like, the ification-ification of culture. Yeah. So why are we doing an episode about OnlyFans and not just any old cam site? Well, something happened around the world in the past few years that made OnlyFans an extremely big deal. Do you want to take a guess as to what that is?
I'm drawing a blank, to be quite frank.
It's something that happened to you.
Everybody else got a bob? I don't know. No, the pandemic.
Oh my god. I actually couldn't tell if you were kidding for a second, and I was like, whoa.
I studied drama.
This is a hardball question. Yes, Hannah, you're right. It was the pandemic, and also that everyone else got a bob. So in 2020, between the months of March and April, so literally the first month of the pandemic, OnlyFans had a 75% increase in signups. This meant that the site was averaging 200,000 users every single day.
Whoa.
New users. Given what we know about camgirling, do you have any guess as to why OnlyFans blew up during the pandemic?
Because everyone was horny and couldn't leave their houses.
Sad. Yes. Especially, I feel like in that first month, we were also on, and I think this kind of was part of it. I think we all lost our horniness by the end of the pandemic, but
I also think everyone was like, how can I keep my life as the same as it can be, but just online?
Online, yeah.
So I think people were just literally like, how can I find the online equivalent to what's going on with me?
Totally.
And I can imagine a lot of creators joined OnlyFans at that time because of the economic instability that like was caused by the pandemic.
Yes, you kind of hit the two major things that were happening here. The first one that you touched on, we're going to talk about a bit later, but what you just said about financial instability is interesting. So going back to the entrepreneurial thing, since we're experiencing this whole idea of like the new normal, people are stuck at home in lockdown, sex workers who had historically worked in other non-camming forms of sex work, like professional porn, street sex work, and like stripping, all needed somewhere to take their business since they were now essentially jobless. Mm-hmm. And OnlyFans was like this new, really accessible way for sex workers to safely make money. And I've read a bit about how it has higher earning potential than other cam sites, for example. OnlyFans essentially is a platform that you can have safe for work and not safe for work content on it. So it was an adult-friendly Patreon almost.
Got it.
But not only that, many people who hadn't previously been in the sex work industry, but who found themselves jobless during lockdown, also turned to OnlyFans for income. And again, OnlyFans had a lot of the same benefits to camming. So flexible work hours, being your own boss, creative control over your business. Some camming platforms had historically also only allowed cisgendered women to join, but OnlyFans doesn't have this restriction. A big draw is that marginalized people like Black, trans, and non-binary sex workers who may be pushed out of a lot of traditional porn studios or cam sites, for example, were able to see more earning potential on a platform like OnlyFans.
Right, got it.
So OnlyFans has been likened to Uber and TaskRabbit. Do you have an idea as to why that might be?
The gig economy?
Yes, my queen.
The gig economy is like the like prevailing villain of this show a little bit. Like it will pop its head in every like few episodes or a couple times a season. And it's like, this is this reason behind some of the issues you're talking about.
Sorry, I was going to be so annoying just now, and I'm going to do it.
Do it. Is it Voldemort? Horcruxes?
No, I was going to say it's the... Oh my god, it's so annoying. The swiper, no swiping-ification of our podcast.
Okay, I'm sorry, guys. Maya has to go to jail. Take away her internet.
It really is swiper, though. It keeps coming up, and we're like, swiper.
Or Voldemort. He keeps coming back.
Yes, so OnlyFans is absolutely influenced by the gig economy. And thinking about some of the criticisms surrounding companies like Uber, could you imagine there being some downsides to the perk that this gig economy model of sex work poses? We kind of touched on some earlier.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just like very competitive, right? So like you could be offering the service, but like if a bajillion people are also, I assume most people aren't actually bringing in like a very high profit. I think also like relying on a company, like a corporation to kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but to like to host your content or to host your work and work under them means that you have to abide by whatever rules that they impose.
Totally.
And if something kind of becomes like a bigger company, as we've seen throughout this season, it usually ends up happening that they impose more restrictions around people who work in adult content.
Yes.
And also like tech CEOs suck and don't care about the people that work for them or who use their websites or apps for labor, and they're not going to be like the best people to rely on.
I would not say they're benevolent.
No.
You're 100% right. Yeah, workers are subject to the whims of the host website. So yeah, if the website makes any change whatsoever, it'll impact you and there's very little recourse.
Yeah.
Also, the whole idea of the gig economy is that more and more these days, people are experiencing job precarity, similar to this idea that you're at the whims of the platform. Full-time work is steadily decreasing. Why is this happening? Well, it benefits companies greatly to essentially not owe their workers anything. So benefits, stability, pay raises, anything. So with the gig economy, what we're seeing is that people are making their own work and getting more flexible work hours. Yes, but it also means that often they're covering the costs and the risks of their jobs. Yeah. So an OnlyFans model is basically putting up the money herself for her camera and sound equipment and her costumes, her backdrops, editing software, whatever she's using for the job, which of course all sex work like historically has been very fraught when it comes to the law, very fraught when it comes to actually corporatizing it. There are basically no benefits or unions in sex work. So it's not like this is different, but because this was such a bit more of a mainstream thing, you'd think that it would have a bit more of that to give, but no, it's part of the gig economy.
But it's like there's no union for Uber drivers, right? There aren't benefits for Uber drivers.
As there, but there were for cabbies. Yeah. Whereas like in sex work, there is no cabbie precedent.
Yeah.
And in an article about OnlyFans and the gig economy, the scholar Gwen Easterbrook Smith talks about how on top of no benefits and few workers' rights, an oversaturation of Uber drivers limited the ability of workers to earn the promised livable wages. And so you can imagine how people flooding into OnlyFans during the pandemic made it, again, even more competitive and oversaturated.
Yeah.
And so we're going to see how all of these things would come into play in the years following the pandemic.
This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the globe. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there is always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected so you can explore the best of cinema, streaming anytime, anywhere. Now streaming on Mubi in North America is a film I've been obsessed with recently, James Ivory's 1987 film, Morris. Adapted from E.M. Forrester's novel of the same name, the film stars James Wilby and Hugh Grant as two young men coming to terms with their sexualities in Edwardian-era England. Morris was ahead of its time in not only its queer storytelling, but also with its visuals, which precede the dark academia and cottagecore trends of today. More than 30 years later, you can still see its influence in films like Call Me By Your Name, which was also written by Ivory, and Saltburn. You can try Mubi for free for 30 days at mubi.com/rehash. That's mubi.com/rehash for a whole month of great cinema for free.
What do you think now, thinking back to like the Sasha Gray episode where she put forward that idea that internet porn was liberating? Mm-hmm. What would you say about that now?
Well, again, like, I think what we kind of got to in the episode is that it was liberating and it was a really great experience for Sasha Grey and for, you know, the other people who are able to achieve the level of success and celebrity that Sasha Grey could achieve. But for everyone else who's been kind of almost like falsely promised that if they join these websites, they could bring in money and make bank, it ends up being like a disappointment and it ends up being something that you don't really see the benefit from.
It's like the American dream keeps reinventing itself and we keep falling for it every time. Yes.
It's interesting that in this form, you know, Western culture generally hates sex workers. They hate women who are sexually empowered also. Like, they hate women. And yet they figured out a way to, like, make a profit, even if it's a percentage of a profit, off of women doing that work in a way that benefits not pimps or people that they see themselves as different as, but like big like tech CEOs or whatever. And they're kind of more willing to push this idea that maybe it's actually empowering and girl boss of you to go ahead and do sex work online, even though, yes, it's a competitive market and there's still so much stigma with having done that work. It's interesting. It's like, we still hate sex workers, but maybe we can make a profit off of them. I don't know.
Totally. And we're going to see how there's this double-edged sword to mainstreaming these types of things.
Yeah.
So in August 2020, Bella Thorne decided to join OnlyFans. Do you want to tell the people who Bella Thorne is, Hannah?
Sure. I'll tell the people who Bella Thorne is. She was on a Disney Channel show with Zendaya in the like 2010s. And I think it's kind of sad because Zendaya has gone from this show to being one of the A-listers of our generation.
One of the only A-listers.
Yeah, really. She's like a household name. She's beloved. She's incredibly talented, has won many awards. And Bella Thorne has not had that career trajectory. She's been in some films. I've kind of from afar, like, seen her, you know, a lot of people keep trying to do makeup brands and like stuff like that. I think she dated Tana Mojo. Oh my God, she's been a bit more of like a troubled person, I think, in the public eye. Or
she has also had a lot more of a troubled upbringing.
Yes. There's a disparity between the careers that each of them had as co-stars. But yeah, she's an actress and I think a multi-hyphenate in some capacity.
She's working in many fields, yes. Yeah, and although her career has kind of flopped like a bit in comparison to Zendaya, she's still really famous. She had 24 million Instagram followers in 2020.
Wow.
So Bella joins OnlyFans and charges $200 for alleged nude pay-per-view photos that were actually falsely advertised. So they weren't nudes, or at least what she said they were going to be. And because of that, she made $1 million in the first 24 hours of being on the platform.
Holy shit.
Which made a ton of fans demand refunds for being bamboozled, obviously.
Right.
Does this feel almost like a bit of an extreme version of the Disney transition to you?
A little bit. I would say that she's had kind of the most extreme journey in that sense. And I think some of the former Disney child stars who've had troubled transitions into adulthood and maybe had troubled adulthood, I think at least got to enjoy the stardom part of it for a bit longer. Or like Lindsay Lohan had a troubled transition into adulthood, but she was still kind of like an it girl. She was in
almost
Mean
to her
Girls.
Detriment, unfortunately.
Yes, of course. And like that wasn't good for her either. But I think with Bella Thorne post Disney, her career didn't quite take off in the same way. She's still famous. And I think that maybe had someone had a similar experience to her back in the day, they might also find themselves venturing into the adult industry because it's just so much more normalized, I think, for celebrities now or people who are like famous adjacent. Totally. I feel like at this point, if you're kind of someone who is famous or was on something and isn't getting work now, your options are to like start a podcast or start an OnlyFans.
Totally. So. Yeah, it's like her version of Miley licking the pole at the VMAs.
You know? Yeah, a little bit. And I think, you know, she's very much embraced being a bit more of a provocateur. I think she like directed a porn for Pornhub and stuff.
She did. Yeah. I just think the main reason it made me think about the Disney girl transition, because I just feel like a big thing with this moment is this idea that like OnlyFans is a reveal system for coveted bodies. Like, people going crazy over these Disney girl, like, sexy moments, like, sexy pop songs. Selena Gomez's first sexy pop song. Miley licking the pole, whatever.
Miley at the VMAs. The fact that that was so new.
Miley licking the pole at the VMAs, yeah.
No, but in the We Can't Stop.
Oh, and then the later transition to We Can't Stop. But even those early, when they're even younger moments.
Yeah.
OnlyFans kind of goes even further by almost capitalizing on that sort of Peeping Tom concept. Like, there's tons of naked people on OnlyFans, but the draw of signing up for Bella Thorne's is that you get to see something that you shouldn't be seeing.
Totally.
Because, you know, she's a traditional celebrity. So basically, Bella scamming all of these people and making millions overnight, literally overnight, made OnlyFans place a cap on how much creators can charge for subscriptions, thus the, like, $5 to $50 subscription range that I had mentioned. Mm-hmm. They also went from weekly to monthly payouts. Obviously, this had a really negative impact for other creators who are less famous and rich than Bella.
Yeah, I remember this.
Yeah, so there were people calling for Bella to redistribute some of her earnings to other people on the site, which she never did, and to this day, she still has an account. A lot of sex workers on the platform referred to this as a sort of gentrification of sex work. Do you think that checks out?
I think that, like, what was happening with OnlyFans already was sort of a gentrification of sex work. I'm not going to blame Bella Thorne, because what she was doing isn't that different than a traditional celebrity choosing to pose nude in Playboy and making a profit off of that that costs money. Like, I think that there's somewhat of, like, a modern equivalency there. I also doubt that she was thinking about those being repercussions through her doing it. I guess she didn't pose nude, which is, scamming for sure. And I'm sure that, like, that caused uproar in there, but I think the business model of OnlyFans and its similarity to something like Uber is already kind of a gentrification of sex work, and the, like, sort of normalization of that kind of work that came with, like, the pandemic, I think was just inevitably going to make it something that was susceptible to things like this, if that makes sense. But, like, yeah, I can see it. There's been a general, perhaps, gentrification of sex work. And this is clearly, like, a kind of event that definitely highlighted what was happening.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it really showcases it, or it kind of escalated it or amplified it in a way.
I mean, clearly, because it made OnlyFans change its policies, which is whack.
Yeah, I personally don't agree with what she did. Like, I think it's really shitty. She basically was like, I'm going to do this. Oh, no, I'm not. Like, you're scamming people.
Yeah, that's
and true. I guess you're playing into men's interest in wanting to see your body, but also there are sex workers who do that and would never make as much money as you. Like, I do think she should have stopped and thought about it for 3 seconds. That's and true. Her not redistributing the earnings, I think, is really gross, personally. But I agree with what you're saying. And I think it goes back to what you're saying about this normalization. Like, a big reason that Bella cited for making an OnlyFans was because she wanted to destigmatize sex work. She said that she thought it would help bring more publicity to OnlyFans. So I do think, in a way, she was kind of ramping it up. Mm. And I kind of think this highlighted issues with this normalization, like, empowerment movement overall. I think in the case of destigmatizing and legalizing something, like, let's take the case of weed, for example, right? The people who were drawn to that out of survival, like, thinking about these low-level weed dealers, for example, going to prison, are harmed the most when the practice becomes safer. Because usually safe just means corporatized. Mm-hmm. Like, so often the destigmatization isn't out of an actual philosophical reason or care for the people who take part in it. It's out of profit. So the reason I don't really like what Bella did, and I don't really buy into her thing, is that most likely she knew she'd make a ton of money and probably knew it would get her name in the papers. She was pretty irrelevant. Like, she was famous, but she was also not relevant. And it did.
Yeah.
And I don't know. The scholar Sophie Sanchez put it really well. She said, while most people turn to sex work to access the resources they need for survival, especially when we're thinking about the pandemic, like, there was a paramedic who got outed in this news article, basically being like, paramedics are sex workers now, and AOC had to be like, no, it's because this paramedic needs to rely on two jobs to survive. Like, OnlyFans did really become survival sex work during the pandemic. Sophie Sanchez says that celebrities have been accused of treating OnlyFans like a hobby.
True.
Which I think is the main issue.
No, I think that makes sense. It's like akin to, like, them doing Cameo.
Exactly. I think there's a big correlation to Cameo here. But I agree with what you're saying, that I don't think it's just Bella Thorne who did it. Like, it was happening before her.
But I also, like, I don't believe that she was doing this because she solely wanted to destigmatize sex work. you don't do something where you make $1 million and pocket that money solely to send a social message to people.
Especially when you're lying about doing it. And like you're like, I'm a sex worker. Actually, I'm not, but I'm still going to make millions. Whereas these sex workers can never be like, hey, I'm going to post my naked body and not post their naked body and not face repercussions.
Because she could also just like take a brand deal with her level of fame and make a profit off of that. Whereas like a sex worker couldn't do that. There aren't like other resources at their finger to just like quickly make a buck online.
Yeah, she did it for funsies and for some extra cash, basically. The pandemic, as you were saying earlier, really cracked open class disparity. And we saw a lot of the public turn on celebrities for being out of touch, thinking back to the Imagine video. I'm sorry for even bringing this up, guys. I hate thinking about it too.
The Imagine video or the pandemic?
If there's anyone I hate to think about, it's Gal Gadot. And that Imagine video was the beginnings.
Imagine all the people.
I think that this was one example of that because, you know, after Bella Thorne, other celebrities like Black China, Tyler Posey, and Tana Mojo also came onto the platform. Mm. And like emphasizing my point about coveted bodies, want to take a guess at who the only person to beat Bella Thorne's record has been?
I'm literally drawing a blank. I know way too much about celebrities.
That's so fair, queen. The only person to beat Bella Thorne's record for making the most money in the shortest amount of time is Danielle Bregoli, or Bad Baby, the Cash Me Outside girl, who joined the platform very soon after she turned 18.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is the other thing about OnlyFans, is that, I mean, again, and I do think that Playboy has been kind of playing this role in a different sense for ages, but they really are creating this thing where, yeah, any young celebrity whose like career longevity is clearly up in the air turns 18 and they're allowed to do it, but it just gross. Feels, yeah.
The response to it feels gross.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Although maybe there were 18-year-old clients on there who wanted to see her, and sure.
Well, yeah.
But sure. I highly doubt that's the case. 18-year-olds are famously broke. So, yeah, going like thinking about Claudia Conway and Playboy, thinking about Denise Richards' daughter, both of whom we've talked about on the pod before.
Yeah.
So, the earnings disparity on OnlyFans is actually pretty crazy. As of 2022, the average OnlyFans creator was making $180 a month, while the top earners, many of whom are celebrities, were making 33% of the total earnings on the platform.
But of course.
So, in the Easterbrook Smith article, she talks about how in the past, a lot of porn stars would like moonlight as full service sex workers to make some extra cash. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of made me think about this idea of leveraging name recognition to build a sex work business.
Yeah.
Like I think that big aspect of online sex work is instead of cruising or being featured on stage at a strip club, there's a lot of brand building and advertising. Like you're saying, very early iterations of influencers were cam girls. So do you think that aspect of, you know, having a big name would have played into celebrities having so much success on there because of this branding stuff?
Well, it's like, why pay to see like a random person naked when you could pay to see like a D-list celebrity that maybe you grew up watching on a TV show naked? Or I think even outside of the sex part of it, I think, like we've said before, it's a curiosity thing as well. So I can imagine that being a driving force. But then, yeah, of course, it's like, if you have name recognition, you're going to get picked over other people in basically every single case, like not just on OnlyFans, but we are like in a celebrity obsessed and worshiping culture.
Do you think a celebrity posting on OnlyFans should constitute as sex work?
I mean, I would be curious to know how they classify it, because I feel like the kind of girl bossification of it, I can imagine that maybe some of these people don't like to consider themselves doing sex work, and that we've kind of created like a new facade for them to do this kind of thing and pretend it's like another thing.
That's why I think the gentrification word, I usually don't love to use gentrification when it doesn't apply to housing, to be honest, because I think it kind of obscures some pretty systemic issues. But I understand its use here because it almost takes the work part out of sex work. Like, it's an industry. No matter how we try to characterize it, majority of the industry is done for survival, like any other job, right? If it ends up being a hobby, you can't really call it sex work because it's a sex it's a hobby. You're making extra cash for fun. I think it just takes that survival aspect out, and I think it's important to keep the survival aspect in, because a lot of normalizing and destigmatizing sex work has been this movement to understand it as work, right?
Yeah.
And treat it as such. And so when it becomes a hobby, how are you supposed to be like, oh, these people need a union, they need benefits, when celebrities are just treating it like a fun...
Yeah, like a side gig that they can kind of do between roles or like between,
exactly, contracts. And not for money, just because. Of course it's slightly for money.
But, I think considering the star level of some of these people, I would assume it is for money.
Yeah.
But these people have a lot more opportunities to make money in other avenues.
Exactly.
Whereas, the people competing with them on OnlyFans may not.
Totally. And I guess, like, you know, thinking about Sydney Sweeney being like, I take on all these brand deals because you never know when your work is going to go away. And I get that, totally. But...
And that is another thing. It's like...
But you can take on brand deals.
I think that fame is a kind of...
Fame is a fickle thing.
Well, it's just this thing that, like, once you have name or facial recognition, it becomes pretty difficult to just get a job outside of something that is related to those things. And that's why, as annoying as this boom of podcasts where people are revisiting their old shows or like just like
the Ned's Declassified podcast,
as annoying as and like cringy as this boom is, it's like, well, yeah, because what else are these people going to be able to do? Like, there's a whole generation of people that will see them on the street and recognize them, and like, yeah, they could be waiters in a restaurant. The girl who played Chelsea on That's a Raven has one of those podcasts, and she was working as a waiter in a restaurant, and she said she liked it, but I can't imagine that she went a shift without having someone born in the 90s go, hey, I know you. And I think that you are limited for options, and it's like, I don't think that any of these people who are joining OnlyFans have any kind of malintentions at heart. You know,
here's a fun thing I'll do.
Or here's
another type of brand deal, except it's OnlyFans.
Yeah, or maybe I'm not relevant enough. Like, Bella Thorne is different because she was more culturally relevant, but some people aren't relevant enough.
And she was still pretty irrelevant as well.
But I mean, in the mainstream culture, she's culturally relevant enough to get a B movie or to do a brand deal. She shows up on like random streamer movies.
I mean, I would argue that she's less relevant than Bad Baby or Black Chyna, though, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I think that they're bigger names than she is. Like, she's a big name, but I don't think that she's necessarily more relevant than those people.
Yeah, that's fair. I just think that there's, like, there's some ways that people are kind of like, yeah, it's annoying that they're all infiltrating these spaces. But when you hear about people who are like, yeah, I was on a TV show 5 years ago, and now I'm literally delivering Uber Eats and stuff, or, like, having to do all these things to keep paying my bills because the money dries up, I don't think that they... all have malintentions.
No, totally. And I think that a lot of the ways that these people blew up, like Bella Thorne in a child show, Daniel Bergoglio on reality TV, Black Chyna on reality TV, it's like, yeah, it doesn't have a lot of longevity.
Like, yeah, Daniel Bergoglio, if her rap career doesn't...
I mean, it did take off.
And it did take off.
She got some great writers.
But the Daniel Bergoglios of the world are kind of limited.
What's Woe Vicky going to do? Probably make an OnlyFans at some point.
I'm sure Woe Vicky has an OnlyFans.
But at the same time, I don't want to treat these people like they're the same as a paramedic needing two jobs.
And that's,
I think, the key difference. But yeah, I do think there is something to be said about fame. Though there are some even bigger celebrities on there. Cardi B joined it in 2020 to promote WAP. And she offers like BTS content about her career on hers. But there's no explicitly sexual content on there. And she's very popular on there. I just wanted to ask what you think about safe for work content being on OnlyFans. Like, someone joining it this late in the game and making safe for work content.
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny to do that. I'm also like, why?
Who is a Patreon, Cardi B?
Like, why do you want to pay for safe for work content?
BTS.
BTS. Yeah. I mean, like, nowadays people will try and, like, get any kind of money that they can.
Any kind of nugget. Like, I think... you can put safer work content legitimately anywhere else.
Yeah.
Make a Patreon. It's the exact same platform, basically. I also just think, let's say Cardi B making it on something like OnlyFans versus Patreon, is that the headline Cardi B makes an OnlyFans is immediately going to grab attention.
Totally.
And so again, you're leveraging this adult content for your own personal gain.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of like you're playing with the aesthetics of sex work. And it's like Cardi B...
she was a sex worker.
Well, exactly. It's already associated with her brand.
But
that
she's very,
like,
detached from it now.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So we're going to come full circle to Fosta Sesta, because in 2021, BBC News reported that there were a number of underage users on OnlyFans, many of them bypassing the age restrictions by using fake IDs or the IDs stolen from older relatives or friends. Like, one girl used her grandma's passport.
What?
Yeah. They also found that some illegal accounts were not getting shut down as quickly as they should be. Accounts could get like multiple warnings from mods instead of actually just getting shut down, even if there was illegal content on there.
Classic.
Yes. So in classic fashion, OnlyFans announced that it would be banning explicit content on the platform. Basically, they had justified it by saying that the ban was to, quote, comply with the requests of our banking partners and payo providers, and that they wanted to safeguard users' funds and subscriptions from increasingly unfair actions by banks and media companies. Putting this in conversation with Fosta Sesta, do you agree with their decision?
I mean, I'm going to assume that a lot of the things that they were kind of called out for in the news were things that they could have invested perhaps the time and the money and the energy into minimizing.
Yeah, why don't you make your age verification better?
Yeah, or like, why don't you like respond to reported or flagged content faster or more efficiently? Like, considering I'm sure how much money OnlyFans was bringing in, they could have done that. I do know that like credit card companies are becoming a lot stricter about being willing to work with companies that engage with like adult or explicit content. And so like, I know, I'm sure that like puts you in a fickle position, but who is in the best position to challenge those companies? It's like a big internet corporation like OnlyFans, right?
Yeah.
Like when we talked about Tumblr's, like Tumblr was really kind of failing and like on the back burner and not culturally relevant. And so they weren't really in the best place to be challenging credit card companies. Yeah. OnlyFans, I think, has a lot more power to do that.
2021.
And like, also, if I'm the person running OnlyFans and I know I'm making most of my money from not safe for work content, why am I messing up my bag like that?
Well, yeah, I think it's so funny to be like, we're safeguarding our users against this when the majority, like a big portion of your users and the whole reason you got famous in the first place is because of the not safe for work people.
Yeah.
We're seeing something obviously similar to what happened with Jennifer Ringley, you know, and that a lot of these adult content sites were being discriminated upon by banks and credit card companies and PayPal. Like in 2020, Pornhub was no longer able to accept credit card payments after it was exposed for having child porn on there. And in 2021, AVN had to demonetize its subscription and video sales wings because they couldn't have access to banking services. But again, a lot of this unduly harms sex workers.
Yes. Well, because it's like when you are no longer able to make your money from sex workers, or it makes it like a little challenging to do so, you don't actually have their back. You're not actually going to like fight for them to keep a platform that you profit from, but also like they need to profit from.
Exactly.
So it's like people getting into this business without any kind of actual compassion for the people that they are employing under that business or like working with. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, like Timothy Stokely made it sound like this was all of a sudden, but OnlyFans had been trying to distance themselves from sexually explicit material since the very beginning, which is so contradictory. Like this one creator, Chelsea Lin, said in an interview with Insider when this happened, "Sex work built OnlyFans, and now it feels like they're turning their backs on us," which is exactly what you just expressed.
But sex sells. Why would you not want it?
And so what I was going to ask, great timing, is that I just wonder what's happening to this concept of sex sells, right? Like, what I've been seeing just in this entire season is that sex, it burns really fast and bright. Like, it'll get into this market. It'll be like, everyone wants sex. Everyone's interested in it. We all want to be Peeping Toms, whatever. It gets in, but then so quickly burns out. Yeah, it's made me wonder about this idea of sex sells. And I think what it is also, and I'll talk about this forever, is that America has this really perverse conception of sex. Like, sex sells when it's being made by men.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like when it's being slightly censored and when it's shown to you in a really perverted way that isn't actual sex, it's a very glossy.
The idea of sex.
Yeah, the idea of sex.
American Pie is all about like pining after the ability to have sex.
Yeah.
And then when they actually have sex at the end, it's kind of like a, oh.
Yeah, totally.
Moment.
They're not letting anyone see actual organic sex. And these platforms that are a lot of the time benefiting women having their own agency are then stripping them of that agency in these kind of pursuits. And obviously, I don't think child porn should be on Pornhub. I don't think underage users should get onto OnlyFans. But tighten up your sites.
Well, yeah, it has to be like a back and forth relationship. And I almost feel like what happens is like sex will find ways to kind of intertwine itself with different movements or platforms or like different things, right? Those things will become very popular, and the more popular they get, the more eyes are on them and the more attention is brought to maybe the sex part. And then it's like the values of the masses have more influence over
them. It's like when the suburbs find out that people are actually having sex, And then they're like, oh no. And every once in a while they find out and they're like, oh fuck, my husband actually watches OnlyFans. Now I need to rally against it, you know?
Well, because it's like, yeah, these things, like OnlyFans seem to be able to like host not safe for work content for a while in like a way that is chill, and then it blows up and then suddenly people are casting judgment on it.
Totally.
So I think it's a bit of like an Icarus thing where, you know, you get too close to the sun and then it's only going to blow up in your face. Like, I don't think there's really a way for you to like have sex and not things about sex in, again, yeah, like a moderated kind of centered way, but actual sex be a mainstream phenomenon. It will never be allowed to exist. We love to use it, the idea of it, to like sell things, but there is such a fine line before it becomes too much.
Totally.
So I don't know. Yeah, I don't think there'll ever be. I think OnlyFans almost seemed like the closest thing. But then as OnlyFans became more popular, it became detrimental to the people on it. So it's like, do we want sex to be mainstream?
No, I don't think that we want sex to be mainstream when it comes to women having agency over that sex and making money off of it themselves. Because of how big the pushback was, they ended up walking back the ban plan, and the platform still hosts a lot of sexually explicit material, but they do implement content moderation. Like, they banned the words fisting and pegging, which that is interesting.
That seems homophobic.
Yeah, a little bit. And obviously, moderation like this can have disproportionate impacts and usually targets marginalized creators more than famous or high-earning ones. And this is all exacerbated by what we talked about in the Tumblr episode, when like regular social media sites are even more puritanical these days and often censor and ban sex workers who are trying to do like a front of house show and promote their OnlyFans on there. Like, someone recently reported one of my photos because in it there was like the faintest outline of like a clothed nipple, and the photo's gone. I have no recourse. It's just done. And it's just insane how sensitive these bots are. It's crazy.
Also, like, how do you program artificial intelligence to recognize that?
A nipple? It's so evil. Especially one that's clothed. It was, like, under a patterned shirt. It's insane.
Like, how... I don't have a mind for technology, but that feels like a bad use of our resources. It could be curing cancer or something.
No, genuinely. Anytime they create this shit, I'm like, cool, now cure cancer. And also... climate change.
The world is on fire, but we cannot see the outline of a nipple on your Instagram.
No. So I just want to end with a discussion about the other major reason that OnlyFans blew up during the pandemic, which you had kind of gotten to when you mentioned that we were all horny. As we all know, lockdown, you know, completely messed with human connection and intimacy. And so as many people who were flocking to OnlyFans to become creators, just as many, if not more, were flocking to it to become clientele.
Well, yes.
When I first started researching for this episode, I kind of thought that since OnlyFans has this sort of like content-based model, it would create a bit more of a distance between the worker and the client. But it turns out that since it kind of encompasses so many forms of sex work, like camming, phone sex, sexting, social media, whatever, it actually makes the illusion of intimacy more intense, which I think you tapped into. In the same way that like men thought of Jennifer Ringley as their virtual girlfriend, we're seeing that also with OnlyFans. In this Insider article from this year by Marta Bino and Madeline Berg, they interview a bunch of clients as well as OnlyFans models, many of whom had been sex workers before they joined the models. Mm-hmm. And they talk about the way that the platform actually heightened their connections with each other. It starts off with one of the creators crying about one of her fans dying. He had terminal cancer, and like she had been interacting with him for a very long time. Mm. So sad. And another one they interview talks about how clients can, quote, go to Pornhub and get naked people in sexual videos, but they come to OnlyFans to make a connection with the creator. And it makes sense because it's so individualized, right? Yeah. Like, you can kind of subscribe to one person's page and you're just getting their stuff. And so it's kind of like, oh, I'm checking in on what my girlfriend's doing.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I think even outside of that, like, we're creating kind of more parasocial bonds with the people that we're seeing online, just in general, across the board, different creators. And so it makes sense that a platform that like allows more of a responsiveness from these people and just like more of a back and forth would further facilitate that.
Does it feel a bit to you almost more similar to seeking arrangement in a way, just in this companionship idea?
Yeah, I guess so. Like, I think probably, especially in the pandemic, I think if you were like a single person, like living alone, you might be very lonely. And when I was backpacking in Europe a couple of years ago and I was like by myself and first acclimatizing myself to that, I was listening to old episodes of my favorite podcasts because I was like a little bit lonely and Friends. I kind of just wanted to feel comforted by that in a weird way. And I think you do kind of feel like the people whose content you engage with, whether it's like, you know, reading someone's Substack, watching their vlogs, listening to podcasts, or watching a creator on OnlyFans, like you feel a connection to them. You feel like you have a relationship with them. And so I can only imagine that there's an extra level of intimacy that comes once you are openly associating it with like sex and romance.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think there is sort of a correlation there. And then when you're not able to seek that out in real life, and I'm sure it's much cheaper to be on OnlyFans than to take someone out on Seeking Arrangements.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes sense.
Yeah, like I can't, if I'm lonely during the pandemic, I can't be like hitting up my friends and being like, hey, send me videos of yourself just doing daily tasks because I'm lonely. But these people are getting paid to send videos of themselves.
Yeah.
Doing all sorts of things as well as sexual videos.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they found in the article that it was also on both sides. Like the models were actually just as attached to the fans as the fans were to them. Why do you think that might be?
Because if you are having a back and forth with these people and they're supplying your livelihood, and I assume, you know, I hope that the things that they're saying to them are really encouraging and like kind. If they're communicating, then like, yeah, you might feel that way. Like those are, it's like when you have a regular at work that you get along with really well, like working in the service industry. Like if something happened to one of those people, I would be upset about it. You know,
yeah, totally.
I see you all the time. And then this is just an even more extreme version of that because of the intimacy there.
Yeah, just so much exposure to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the creators also cite social alienation as the reason for being so drawn to fans. One of them talked about how she doesn't date in real life because her job is so stigmatized and she doesn't want to have to talk about it. Or like a lot of people don't want to date someone who has this job.
Right.
So she doesn't bother dating at all. And OnlyFans for her kind of makes up for that gap.
I see.
Yeah.
Right.
And they were saying that there are some benefits to this intimacy. You're less lonely. And this 2023 study found that OnlyFans users reported actual improvements in their relationships. Better communication, more intimacy in real life, and better boundaries. It's almost like opening up your relationship. As we were saying, a lot of married men were on here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating because I think it almost brings some release to the pressure of monogamy in a weird way.
I mean, I think a debate about whether or not porn is cheating is so, so silly. We've talked about that in our mini episodes on our Patreon.
If I was married to someone for decades and they wanted to talk to some girlies on the internet, I'd be like, okay, because that takes some pressure off me to be the one to always have to do it, if I'm not feeling like that.
Yeah, and there still is the clear boundary of consumer and creator, right?
Yeah.
You would assume so, that it's different.
If they fell in love with the OnlyFans model and wanted to get together with her, I'd be like, okay, we're done. You are emotionally cheating on me, but that's a bit different, I think.
Yeah, and that would be kind of, I'm sure, against the rules of what that relationship is supposed to be.
Were we talking about how there was a country where it was socially acceptable to sleep with sex workers if you were married?
No, but is it France?
No, it's, I think, somewhere in East Asia.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I don't know who told me this recently, but I would love to let us know if you know which country this is. Oh my god. But to end off the episode, do you see any issues with this intimacy thing?
Well, yeah, there's always issues with having like parasocial bonds through the internet. When you're a woman on like a receiving end of it, it can be a scary experience, right? And then when you add in the fact that like this is somebody who feels connected to you because they're consuming your adult content, I think that even heightens the relationship. So I think that as much as online sex work is safer than street sex work or escorting, there are still its own risks that come with it, right?
It's like the I Fell in Love with a Stripper, whatever. Those songs. All those songs about falling in love with a stripper, you know?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And if you know what song Maya is referring to, let us know in the comments
below.
Yeah, I think, of course, there's drawbacks. People can be crazy on the internet.
Yeah.
People don't always have a good sense of like boundaries and like what is real and what isn't real.
It's not good for the client as well. Like a lot of people also reported that their OnlyFans connections made them feel even lonelier. And there's a sex addiction specialist that they interview who likens it to eating a whole bag of chips but never feeling full.
Yeah, I can also see that, especially if you're someone who's not inclined to go out into the world anyways and like try and meet people in real life.
It keeps you at home.
Yeah, it's kind of like a safety net. It's like you don't have to do that if you want to get a certain level of gratification. So, yeah, like, there's pros and cons to everything. I think in a good situation, it can be nice, but I'm sure that there are a lot of less nice versions of it.
Well, and so I'm going to get into those quickly. Yeah. What I was saying about it actually bolstering relationships and making them better, it also fucks them up, real-life relationships. These women are offering, like, an idealized experience of a girlfriend without any of the baggage or, right, like, work involved in maintaining a relationship with them. And, like, obviously this has a limit. Like, if men are feeling lonely because of greater systemic issues, obviously OnlyFans is just a band-aid to those issues. And, you know, emotional labor has always been a part of sex work, but they say that OnlyFans makes it kind of more of a thing because it's so accessible. Like, it's an app that you can access anywhere at any time of day. And because it's built like a social media app, it can be easily become a crutch, right? Like, you can check it as often as you're checking Instagram. So it's just kind of this negative feedback loop because you can get an addiction to it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, like, people do get addicted to porn. And this, I'm sure, is an even more extreme version of that. But I can definitely see that being an issue. I'm sure it's also similar to being a content creator where you're never off the clock.
Exactly, yeah.
So, like, if people are trying to engage with you, you need to kind of tend to that relationship, and you can't really say, oh, you know, I'm, like, in the middle of doing something right now, I'm not going to engage with the people who are paying my bills.
Well, it's like the gig economy, like, investing time, right?
Well, yes.
So with all this being said, on the topic of intimacy and addiction, this will take us very neatly into next week's episode.
Cliffhanger!
Rehash is hosted by Hannah Rain and me, Maia. It's produced and edited by me, and the intro and outro song is produced by our talented friend, Ian Mills. Thanks for listening.